Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I'm here today with a good buddy and a neighbor of mine in the restaurant industry. I'm here with Will Tigert, the owner of Freeman's Alley and Peel's Restaurants, and also Gothic Wines. Will, it's great to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You know, at your restaurants, you definitely focus on wines that are small production, that are very high quality. I really love your wine list. But one of the things that struck me, and one of the first places that I had this kind of wine was that you have these great balanced American wines, and you're doing it at Freeman's. Way before I think a lot of people were doing it, and that was definitely one of the first places that I got into these kinds of wines. Where did you get this inspiration?
Well, we've been doing an international program at Freeman's from the beginning with a lot of French wines, but then we've also being an American restaurant, we felt we had to represent the home team. So we spent some time going out to California, to Oregon, to New York, to the wine producing regions domestically. They're easier to get to, and especially on our restaurateur schedule. And everyone speaks English, so that also helps. And just having these relationships. Also, New York being such a mecca for wine, these people are here. They're in the market. You can see them, meet them, hang out with them. Not to say that they don't. The Europeans are also very well represented, but I think also that a lot of it is that American wine is still a young industry, and there's this whole new generation of people in the wine industry that are third, fourth generation, and they're here in New York, and they're hanging out, and they're partying, and they're. You get to meet them and then have that direct connection to the producer and into the vineyards. And then that kind of started a lot of the relationships. And then they've just built over time.
And do you remember some of the first wines that you had in that style?
I think some of the Hirsch Vineyard Pinot Noirs, I think it was we opened Freeman's in 2004. So it's probably when they just started making their first production. And I met David at one of the Skarnik tastings, and I was really, really impressed with the wines, as well as I'm trying to think who else another, one of some of the very first. There was Stafford Hill or Holleran Pinot Noirs that Planner brought in. It basically started with Pinot for me, and then kind of spread out to a lot of the other varietals, and then to some of the old Napa cabs. I was fortunate to get into the wine industry, around the time I opened the restaurant, so about 10 years ago. And so I didn't have a lot of the kind of the cult cab blow up that happened in the 90s, or I wasn't, so I had a lot of, didn't have a lot of preconceived notions of, what American wine was. And so I was tasting all this cool techie stuff from the, that was in the market, just coming into the market at that time. So it was really interesting and a good time to be introduced to, Kathy Corazon when they were, first gaining a lot of traction in New York. They've been here forever, but they just got a whole new, wave of momentum in some of the older, Napa properties.
And tell us about this time when you were opening up the restaurant, just experiencing, just getting into the wine industry. What was your impetus for opening up the restaurant? How did it all come together? And then how did you end up also doing the wine program?
Well, we are the first person that we had work help us out, because we started the wine industry. we opened up Freeman's. I had very little experience with wine. I did the American Sommelier classes for, you know, the 6 months we were opening the restaurant, and then Vanessa Boyd helped us out with our first list that she stopped working at Morel. So she came in and wrote us this like super techie list, and we really didn't know that much about wine. So we're like, okay, this looks great. Well, you know, we weren't burdened with previous knowledge. So, you know, she put on all these really small producers, and even, you know, some of our, people in the wine industry looked at our list and were like, you know, there's none of the greatest hits here. This is all like super, you know, it was all like, you know, Muscadet, Grower Champagne, you know, at the time, stuff that was really new. And we were like, yeah, well, this is great. This tastes good. We're just trying to, you know, keep the wheels on the restaurant. We didn't know what we were doing. So, and then it just evolved from there. And then we started out, you know, holding the kind of boutique banner, and we just kind of kept it. And then, you know, once we became successful, a lot of the, you know, the big champagne houses came knocking, wanting placements, and a lot of other people, you know, oh, you have to have, this is a wine you have to have on your list, and this is like a New York wine, and that everyone has. And we just like kind of just stuck to our thing, and then grew the list and, you know, got more space, and as Freeman's grew. And then when we opened Peel's, we wanted to do mostly a domestic list. And so we had we hedged our bets, and we had a few, we had a few European producers, and we had champagne, because it was like, okay, well, we can't not have champagne, especially because it was going to be a daytime focused place, and we love drinking champagne. But then within a year of opening Peel's, we transitioned to an all domestic list, which was kind of interesting, because I don't think I think there's only a few restaurants in New York that were doing that.
Yeah. So tell us, back up a little bit. Sure. Tell us a little bit about what you were doing before you opened up Freeman's, and what was the impetus? What made you to decide to choose that random alley in the Lower East Side?
Well, yeah, I mean, personally, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I had a design company in Detroit. I'm a Midwest kid. Sold the company in the late 90s, and then moved to New York because I wanted to, you know, expand out of Detroit. And then I was looking for a new gig, and I wanted to open a bar because I thought that would be cool, and that'd be a way to meet people and get ingratiated in a new city. And then I met my business partner, Tavo, and he was trying to open up a cafe in the Lower East Side. And I was like, well, can we put a bar in it? And he's like, okay, yeah, we'll put a bar in it. And so he, you know, he found the alley because he was throwing a bunch of parties, and he wanted a space to throw a party. And then so we found the space, and the owner was like, well, you could throw a party, but I don't want the traffic on the front of the building, so you have to go through this alley in the back. And he looked at the alley, we looked at the alley, and he's like, we're like, oh, can we just rent this little space in the back? You know, will you give it to us for cheap because you can't sell it? And at the time, Freeman's was a soup kitchen. It was the Bowery Residence Committee. It was, you know, one of the kind of part of a lot of the services down on the Bowery servicing. You know, people, homeless folks, and, you know, needle exchanges and stuff. So it was, you know, people come into Freeman's and they think, oh, this has been here forever and this is really old. But I mean, it was the mechanical room of a soup kitchen. It was like linoleum tile and a giant, air exhaust unit. And it was, and neon lights and not, I mean, it was terrible. It was just like, so we gutted the whole thing and we built it ourselves over a 9 month period. It's kind of every day. And, then we opened it up and everyone was like, oh, this is something that you just like found and, decorated. But you know, it was all very intentional. And then it became a hit, and we expanded it twice. And now we have, you know, almost 9,000 square feet, and we have a large second floor that we do, a lot of private events, but we kept the scale of it small. So it still feels very residential. It feels like you're going into like a townhouse or an old house in New York.
You know, I'm always impressed by the design of your restaurants. I love Freeman's. Does have that really classic feel, and it's really great to hear you say that, you know, it was so intentional because you're there, it feels completely natural. And one of my favorite rooms of yours is the second floor at Peel's, overlooking the Bowery and the Ramon sign from the bar. I think that is just an awesome, awesome room. What's the inspiration? Who's involved and in charge of the design of the restaurants?
My partner Tavo Sommer is an architect by trade. He did all the designs of the restaurant. He's a very talented designer. His process is very organic. So he kind of comes in and, he has sketches of what he wants to do. And then we kind of move towards that. And then as he's working, you know, things will evolve and change. But, even Freeman's, it's kind of like we've built that restaurant and stripped it down and rebuilt it three times now. Peel's, even with Peel's, like the ground floor, we opened with this large communal table and this kind of diner counter, and then and this to-go bakery, and that's kind of morphed into, now you go in there, it's booth seating, there's a bar, we're expanding, we're constantly just kind of changing. Any good restaurant, especially one in a place as cutthroat and dynamic as New York, has to be dynamic. And, maybe you hit it the first time out and everything's perfect and just gels. I mean, the front room of Freeman's hasn't really changed since we've opened it, except for, some of the decorations. But, at Peel's, we've been, changing. We're putting a new bar in the front. We're changing and evolving the way the space works, because it's like the best laid plans. You have this perfect design of how it's going to work, and then you put people in it, and you put alcohol in it, and you put 5,000 people through the restaurant, and you're like, well, the servers can't get around this corner, and they keep on hitting it, and so we have to change this, or no one likes sitting in this booth. Okay, well, don't just be like, that's going to be the bad seat. Let's change it. Let's rip it out. Let's put something else in. So it's,
I think that's one of the most fun and creative parts about the opening of the restaurant. Once you are open, then going through the process and seeing what are those changes, what are those adaptations, and we had to do a bunch of that at La Picho that we just opened up. I think that's an exciting and creative time, as long as you look at it like that and don't get too frustrated with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a high wire act. It has to be effortless and it has to look graceful. At the same time, if you slip up, you're going to be falling towards the net. So it's fun and it's exciting, but at the same, it's definitely a process.
So at what point did you take over the wine buying for the restaurants?
We worked with Vanessa for like a year or so, and then we worked with my now partner on Gothic, Josh Nadell, for a couple years, and then I took it over full time probably about 6-7 years ago. Mm-hmm. Doing all the wine buying. And for me, it was just great because if all I had to do was run the restaurant, it might have been get boring after a while, or get not necessarily boring but monotonous. So the wine world is just it's just such like a vast world, and it's a great way to be creative and to meet people and travel, and so it's been a great outlet for me to have this great platform to kind of to focus on wine at Freeman's, and then now at Peel's.
Yeah. What's one wine that will always be on your list no matter what?
One wine that will always be on our list. Let me think. I would say at Freeman's we've had a couple wines that we've had since the day we've opened. One would be it's a very popular wine now, but the Quateau from Crochet for the Sancerre we've had since we've opened, and it's always been like just a super solid wine. Another one would be Chateau Le Mouf. It's a Bordeaux, white Bordeaux, Sauvignon Blanc, we've been on been the house wine at Freeman's since literally the day we've opened. And we've met the people from the chateau, and they're always happy to see us, because like we've literally sold containers of their wine. And so that's been, and it's now that wine is a lot more popular, but like when we started, it was like, I mean, that wine was like, we had on the wine list for like $6 a glass or something like that when we first opened. And now I see it on the wine list for like 16, But it's been there's certain properties that you know, that we've been supported the whole time, and it's nice to always have the standards and then always have new room to grow.
All right. Well, we're going to take just a quick break, but when we get back, we're going to talk about what are some of your new finds. And I apologize if you've been listening to me slurping and enjoying the gothic Pinot Noir, but I'm going to ask you all about that as well.
Great, thanks.
This one's Big Pants by Rectech on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
And we're back on In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I've got a big smile. You can't see it, but it's because I'm drinking some really tasty Pinot Noir from Gothic. Will, can you tell us a little bit about your project of Gothic Wines?
Sure. Gothic Wines is a wine label that I started with my partner, Josh Nadel, who's the beverage director at the Dutch Le Conde Verde, and the soon-to-be-opened Lafayette in New York City. I've been working with him for about 7 years, and first on the wine list at Freeman's, and then through that, some other small projects, and then we decided to start working on Gothic Wine. We make Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and a Rosé, all out of Oregon. We're coming up on our third vintage. So we're very excited about that, and it's been going really well.
Logistically, how does this work? You're on the East Coast, Oregon's on the West Coast.
Logistically, it gives me a real business reason to be in Oregon 4 or 5 times a year, which is great, because if I didn't have that, as you know, in the restaurant industry, you just get sucked in. It gives me a little bit of balance, gets me out on the West Coast. But it's a négociant project, so we contract fruit contracts with specific vineyards, some of which we've been working with for 3 or 4 years now, and then we have a custom crush facility in Dundee, right in the Willamette Valley, and they produce the wine for us, and then we sell it here in New York, and we're in about 7 states right now. So we're in New York, you know, kind of the Northeast, you know, Connecticut, New Jersey, Massachusetts. We just started in California, Texas, Florida.
And when you were looking for fruit to source, for growers to work with, what was your process?
We started kind of, we had a good time. Our first vintage was the 2009 vintage, which was a large vintage for Oregon, as far as there was a lot of fruit available. So, Oregon is a challenging environment as far as there's a lot of vintage variation with a lot of it between the weather. There, they struggled to get the grapes ripe on some years, though they've kind of honed in over the past, especially over the past 10 years, and really have, brought the quality of the wines up and really figured out when to pick, when not to pick. And so, we kind of went out and met a bunch of the vineyards, toured the properties, tasted the fruit, did some kind of historical tastings, and then kind of settled in and worked on the blending process. I mean, we started with our kind of signature Pinot Noir, which is Nevermore, which is a blend from three vineyards. One's Monk's Gate. It's kind of it. There's a, I don't want to get too technical on all of the little AVAs in Oregon, but it's a kind of a it's a mix of one vineyard from each of the three main AVAs: the old Amity Hills from Willacaya, from Monk's Gate and Yamhill Carlton, and then from Highland and McMinnville. And so, I mean, basically, we tasted through a lot of stuff, and we found that the ones we really liked were the oldest, happened to be the oldest ones. So then we, after that, we kind of honed in on, like, what are the older vineyards? What are the ones that have, you know, been in production since the early 80s, from the 70s? We do a lot of work with Highland Vineyard and Marsh Vineyard, and those are both two of the oldest vineyards in Oregon.
So you say, so vine age or vineyard establishment age is what really was the difference?
I think a little bit of... A little bit of both. The older vines, I mean, this is all pre-phylloxera. There wasn't any phylloxera, or people weren't even, that wasn't even on the radar. They were just like, let's try to make wine. So they weren't worried about, root stock as much. So a lot of these vines have had a lot of time. You're working with a lot of volcanic soils. So they, and they kind of have the, the famous Jory soil, which is this red volcanic soil that they do a lot, that they have in a lot of places in the Willamette Valley. So they have a lot of time for these, 30-year-old vines, which is old, really old for American wine, at least especially in Oregon, and to drill down. And then even though these are really, there's now phylloxera and there are now some of these problems, the older vineyards don't really have much issues because they've had so long to establish. And so, and they just produce the more, the fruit that had the kind of depth and character. A lot of things that we were looking at were from, we're big Burgundy heads. And so, when we looked at California and we looked at, there was some great stuff in California, especially the Sonoma Coast, but it was just too expensive for us coming in to start our sort of wine. We wanted a wine that we could pour in our restaurants and a wine for on-premise guys like ourselves, for folks in the restaurant industry. So, that's what we focused in on Oregon, as having a lot of value.
Yeah. And, I'm tasting it and it does remind me a lot of the wines that I do enjoy from the Sonoma Coast, the kind of medium bodied, very balanced, bright, fresh, crisp fruit, fresh, crisp acidity, a little minerality even, which is fun to see in a red wine. Very balanced, very, very drinkable, really tasty. Is that, what's the style that you're going for? Because to me, it really does remind me of those kind of cooler climate, edging up on the Pacific Ocean, kind of Pinot Noirs.
Yeah, well, we're looking for a food-friendly wine. Again, we're in the restaurants pouring wine for people to eat with, to eat with. So we want lower alcohol. We don't want super high extraction. We don't want, 14.5, Pinot Noirs. A lot of the high scoring Pinots or just high scoring wines in general for a long time. This is changing now, of course, but we're kind of high alcohol, powerful wines that people equated power with quality. We love softer wines. I want to be able to drink a couple wines through the meal and still be able to walk home. So we're looking for something that we can pair with food. The wine that we're drinking right now, I think, is...
The Gothic Nevermore Pinot Noir 2010.
Yeah, it's, this is a 13.5, which is, I think, in 2009 was a really ripe vintage, was the only vintage that we've done anything over 14% alcohol. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've just stuff...
This feels lighter. I would even call it even a little bit lower.
Yeah, I mean, we have... those are the actuals on the wine, but we have some stuff we do from the Marsh Vineyard that has, is 12.8. And then people are like, well, this is, some people, it's what tastes good in your glass. So there's some people that are like, oh, this is too soft. This is like strawberry juice. I want something, a little more, you know, that's going to take the edge off the day. And there's other people that, you know, this is really what they hone in on. And, you know, but for what we want, for restaurant service, and, you know, I think of wine as a grocery. It's like, you know, it's wine is on the table. It's with food. So, not that I don't like to drink it by its own, but it's, you know, I'm looking for, that's what we're going for. So
I have to ask you something I've always wondered. I mean, you look like a nice Midwestern boy. Like, we're wearing the same pair of New Balance sneakers. Like, what, where did, and I know Josh as well. He's certainly not, you know, very gothic. Where did that name Gothic come from?
Well, I mean, a couple places. One, you know, despite my my calm appearance and demeanor, you know, I was an industrial kid in Detroit. I definitely I can't say that I, you know, I wasn't at didn't, you know, break a tooth in a Skinny Puppy concert in the early 90s spent some time wearing a lot of black when I was in high school, but really, you know, Gothic for me is more Gothic Nevermore. We really take that inspiration more from the Gothic literature. So we're looking at you know, this Nevermore is from Edgar Allan Poe, of course, but also just, you know, that kind of feeling and that kind of atmosphere. I mean, part of it, so, you know, we went to spend a lot of time in Oregon, and you know, we were there all times of the year. So in the winter especially, it's very gray, it's very moody, it's very evocative. Every time we would go and visit these vineyard properties, there'd be all this like mist rolling over the hills, and, you know, I kept on waiting for, like, there's lots of these, you know, large crows and hawks, and you see them on a bunch of Oregon wine labels. And you know, it really had that kind of feeling. We were sitting on this hilltop and just watching the mist like roll through, you know, the pine trees and into the vineyards. And it had that kind of dark, brooding kind of atmosphere. And, you know, the kind of wines we were looking for, you know, are kind of a little bit more kind of, you know, I wouldn't say the, you know, color-wise, we're not looking for super dark wines, but it was that kind of feeling, that kind of like rainy day wine, where it had a lot of texture and it was complicated, but had character.
And to change the subject to something a little bit lighter and happier.
It's the first day of spring. It's really nice.
And, you just got engaged. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What did you drink to celebrate your engagement?
We were actually, I just got engaged to my fiance, Yusa. We actually, in true wine fashion, we did it at a vineyard. We were at Soder Vineyards in Oregon. At Mineral Springs Ranch. It's a beautiful vineyard on the kind of overlooking Carlton. She didn't know what was going on. So we did a tasting, and we had a rare, like, beautiful day, spring day like today, with lots of sun. And so we did a full tasting. Then we were walking out and, you know, looking over the vineyards in the valley, and popped the question. And then the Soder people, who were great, were totally in on it, and they brought out the Soder sparkling brut wine, the new vintage that isn't even out yet. And so we drank some of the, you know, best sparkling wine in America, and one of the most beautiful vineyards in America, and it was great.
Yeah, how could she say no?
Yeah, if she said no, it was gonna be, you know, I would just lay it down. It wouldn't. That was my best shot.
Yeah, wow. And I'm such a huge fan of those wines as well. I wish they were more available. I've been trying to buy the Soder Brut Rosé since we opened La Picho, and it's just not.
Well, they had the 90. They had the 98 in the market for a long time, and then he bought a new vineyard. He used to be over on I think on Beacon Hill, and then he moved to Middle Springs Ranch, and the vine, it's just now hitting third leaf. So, and then, you know, the beautiful and frustrating thing of sparkling wine is it takes so long. So he's been, you know, laying it down, doing the Ritalin for a year, you know, for a couple of years now, and now it's just going to be in the market. So this fall, you should definitely see some. You should talk to the Soder guys.
Great, and you guys should definitely look out for it. Their still wines are absolutely delicious as well, but I think that sparkling brut and the brut rosé are like
they're really nice.
They're really special.
He does a good job.
Also, just have to give you a shout and a thank you. Pretty much all of us at the restaurants go, at least all the guys at least, go to the FSC barbers to get these coiffed hairdos. Thanks for that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we just opened up a new barbershop here in Brooklyn on North 8th near Wythe. So it's our third one in New York and our fourth one overall. So
and the fourth one in out in San Francisco,
right? You're right, yeah. On Valencia, 18th and Valencia.
Yeah, I was walking out of one of my favorite restaurants in San Francisco, Bar Tartine, and I was like, oh, my friends are here too.
Yeah, I think since we opened that in like 2 years ago, and since we've opened that, 10 restaurant properties have opened up in Valencia. It's just a huge like boom. Up and down that whole street, and there's just so many great restaurants and great places to drink wine, and Bartichine being like, you know, one of the top.
All right, well, Will Tiger, thank you so much for being on In the Drink. I really appreciate it. Definitely encourage everyone to go check out Freeman's Alley and Peel's, and check out the Gothic wines. They are absolutely delicious. You'll definitely see me at the restaurant soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys, and thanks to you for listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.